I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Working for a news organization, I believe that there are real facts and that some things are demonstrably true. But human beings are not always that rational. Sometimes believing in falsehoods, in fooling ourselves, has a deeper psychological benefit and meaning. Our guest, Shankar Vedantam, host of NPR's Hidden Brain, explores this phenomenon in his new book, Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain, written with Bill Messler. He writes that believing our children are the best kids in the world helps us through the darker days of parenting, that self-delusion can play a role in happy marriages and relationships, that believing you are playing with expensive high-end golf clubs can actually make you a better golfer, that the placebo effect can play a role in surgery. Shankar Vedantam joins us on Radio Times to help us navigate the world of useful, and if I can say useless, delusions, and it's a great pleasure. I'm a big fan of your show. Shankar Vedantam, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty. I've been a fan and admirer of this show for many, many years, so it's a delight to be on today.
Well, I really appreciate that, especially coming from you. Let me begin in the beginning where you write that you have always been intrigued by con artists. You also say you are a card-carrying rationalist. What has been your interest in con people or con artists?
You know, I have to say this at a journalistic level, stories of con artists are often very interesting stories. I remember we did an episode of Hidden Brain many years ago that looked at the world of art forgery and just the ways in which con artists go about it, what they do, the psychology involved in pulling off a con. Very often, certainly the case with art forgery, you know, part of the con is the skill of the artist, the forger. But part of it also is in the psychology of the people being conned, their willingness to go along with the con. So the psychological dynamics of cons are things that I find very interesting, and they've held my attention for many, many years.
Well, a central story in this book, and I'm going to do a very shorthand version of it, is about a con artist, a guy named Donald Lowry, founder of the Church of Love. He had this elaborate scheme where he pretended to be dozens of different women. He wrote love letters to unsuspecting men. They fell in love. They sent him money. And interestingly, at his trial, as you write, many of these recipients, these men, defended him. What does that reveal to us about this power of self-deception?
Yeah, it's a bizarre story at many levels, Marty. Donald Lowry was this middle-aged, balding man in a small Midwestern town. And over a course of like two decades, he wrote tens of thousands of love letters impersonating various women whom he had invented. He called these women angels. And these love letters went out to a mailing list that at its height numbered about 30,000 people in the United States. Many people receiving the letters believed that they had fallen in love with their soulmates. And when their soulmates asked for money to help with various, you know, expenses, these men willingly wrote checks or sent other gifts that were sometimes called love offerings. The truly astonishing part of the whole story is that when Lowry was finally put on trial for mail fraud, some of the members of the Church of Love showed up at his trial to defend him because they had come to rely so much on the love letters. The women whom they thought they were corresponding with had become such central characters in their lives that the idea of giving up this fantasy, of giving up these relationships, was too painful for them to bear. I'm reminded of the movie The Truman Show, which came out some years ago. And in that movie, which has sort of similarities to the Church of Love con, you know, there is a central character, Truman, who is in the middle of a reality show, except he's the only one who doesn't realize that he is in a reality show. His wife, his friends, his family, his colleagues, everyone in the town that he lives in, they're all actors, and he's the only one who doesn't realize he's part of a reality show. And the question is, when will Truman pierce the veil of deception that is all around him? And as the movie unfolds, people who watch the movie will remember this. The difficulty was not just in, you know, getting around the deception that had been woven around him, but the fact that in order to get around that deception, Truman had to give up many of the relationships he thought were central in his life. He had to come to terms with the fact that his wife was not his wife, that his best friend was not his best friend, that his colleagues were not his colleagues. And it was very painful and difficult for him to do that. And this is true for all of us. when you think about the ways in which our beliefs are often embedded in our social relationships, in our intimate relationships, we can start to see why it becomes very difficult for us to give up certain beliefs, even beliefs that are demonstrably delusions, and even beliefs that could be sometimes be deeply harmful to us.
And picking up on this Church of Love and Donald Lowry and these men that defended him in court, it's because they believed they had this relationship. They believed that they were in love with this person who was actually ripping them off, because one could also imagine being furious that someone was lying to you for years and taking your money for completely, you know, bogus reasons.
Yeah, and I think that happened. I think there were many members who had the traditional response, and they were outraged that they had been conned, and they were furious at Don Lowry, and they were happy to testify for the prosecution. But there were also other men who had formed these relationships, not so much with Don Lowry, but with the women they thought they were corresponding with. And these relationships, some of them unfolded not over a matter of weeks or months, but over a matter of years. Some of them had signed mystic marriage pledges, believing that they had married the women that they were corresponding with. They had poured out their hearts to these women over the course of many years, explaining things that had happened in their own lives, often seeking comfort from these women, you know, emotional support from these women. The women had often, the letters often were very supportive. They had very positive emotional tones. Some of the men at Don Lowry's trial, and the interesting thing is some of these people actually testified for both the prosecution and the defense, testified that letters from the Church of Love had kept them from addiction. Two people said the letters from these angels had kept them from committing suicide. So the interesting thing that I think the con raised for me was the idea that, you know, when I initially came by the story of the Church of Love, my reaction to the story was the reaction that everyone is going to have to a con like this, which is that there's a con artist. He's done something seriously wrong. It's right that he's been brought to justice, and it's right that he's gone to jail. But when you start to listen to some of the members, you start to say, well, hang on a second. If these letters are keeping some people from suicide, can I be categorically certain that the entire con was a bad idea? Certainly for the people whom it kept from suicide, it's hard to make that argument.
Can we say there's something about the brain, or are we talking about some of these people were just lonelier and frankly, more needy or needier than others? Or was there something about that this tells us about how our brain can work under certain circumstances?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it is absolutely the case that the people who probably depended most deeply on the Church of Love were, in fact, very, very lonely. And in fact, they were very isolated. In fact, that's true for many of the people whom I describe in the book, including sort of a central character whose story I explore in some depth. It's absolutely the case that, in fact, their lives, you know, they experienced their lives as stunted, that their lives didn't feel complete. And the Church of Love, in some ways, provided them with something that basically filled out their lives. The deeper insight here, though, is that the members of the Church of Love, in some ways, are like the rest of us, or rather, we are like the members of the Church of Love in this very important way. It's very easy to stand outside of the con and basically look down at the members of the Church of Love and basically say, you know, these people are idiots for believing, not just falling for a ridiculous con, but falling for it so deeply that they want to defend it when it's finally being brought to justice. So it's very easy for us to stand outside of the con and basically look down at the people who are con. But I think the deeper lesson of the Church of Love is to say, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. Because in fact, it is the case that when all of us experience setbacks or vulnerabilities in our lives, our brains often turn to beliefs that can help support us. In some ways, this is a healthy thing that all of us do. You know, think about what's happened to all of us in the last 12 months of the pandemic. You know, many of us have come up with rituals or beliefs or various, you know, various ways to cope with the difficulties of the pandemic. I know, speaking just for myself, I have told myself through the last 12 months of the pandemic, every month I have said, you know, liberation is 1 month away. And the fact that I've told myself liberation is 1 month away might be a delusion, but it's been a useful delusion in the sense that it's helped me psychologically cope with the difficulties of the pandemic, the challenges of the pandemic. And I think this is one of the deep insights that I've tried to explore in the book, that in some ways, the ability to do away with delusions, to stand away from beliefs, could be seen as an act of privilege. If your life does not lack for things, it's easy to look down on people who reach for beliefs because their lives, in fact, are vulnerable or they're experiencing great anxiety.
It also seems to say, as you said, every month you said, you know, we're almost at the end of this thing. And of course, 12 months later, you know, we're maybe seeing a light at the end of the tunnel, but that there's something about optimism, even sort of a cockeyed optimism, seems to get us through these tough times.
Indeed. I mean, and right now I haven't yet been vaccinated. I'm not yet in the age group where the vaccines are available, but I certainly believe that the moment I get a vaccine, and this is probably not true, but I'm telling myself, I'll be able to do many of the things I wasn't able to do before. And, you know, when public health officials basically come along and tell us, well, you know, you might still have to wear masks or there still will be all these restrictions, there's a part of me that doesn't want to hear what they have to say because the last 12 months have been quite difficult for me. And I haven't seen family members, including family members who need my help, for a very long period of time. And the idea that having a vaccine will allow me to do those things is something that is very important for my psychological well-being. Now, you know, a month from now, if it turns out that, in fact, there are limitations, I might come up with other rationalizations or other beliefs that help me cope. But it would be wrong in some ways from the outside to look down on me and say, isn't he being ridiculous or isn't his belief systems ridiculous because he's found a way to cope with this terrible experience.
How does those self-deception serve? How did it serve us evolutionarily speaking? I mean, if it's about survival, one would think, well, you need to be rational and you need to be vigilant and you need to be aware and you need reason and logic, and that will help you survive the savannas.
Yeah, and I think the connection with evolution is a really important question because, again, the origins of the self-deceiving brain, you know, lie in our deep evolutionary history. So I'm glad you brought that up, Marty. It's absolutely the case that it's important to be able to see reality for what it is. If you're an antelope wandering around the savannah and a lion pops up around the corner, it's not helpful to imagine that the lion is an illusion and is not real, because the odds are if you believe that, you're going to get eaten and you're not going to pass on your genes. So seeing reality for what it is, in fact, has tremendous survival value. But it turns out that seeing reality for what it is sometimes does not have survival value. And this is where I think the complexity comes in, which is our brains are partly in the business of showing us reality, but they're also partly in the business of not showing us reality. And let's step back for a second just to look at how this works at a very basic level. You know, many of us think of our brains as being a computer or a camera or a microphone, that it basically it's a computer that is basically recording what's happening in the outside world. This, in fact, is not the case. Our brains, in fact, are filtering the outside world in all kinds of ways. At the very simplest level, you know, when we look out at the world, for example, at any given moment, our eyes take in about a billion bits of information. But it turns out that if you send all of this information to the brain, we're quickly going to get swamped by a lot of information that isn't useful. So our brains do a lot of filtering to show us, in fact, a very narrow fraction of what it is our eyes are actually seeing. What we actually see might be a delusion, but it turns out this filtered version of reality is actually a more useful version of reality than reality itself.
We're going to take a very short break talking about reality and delusions.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Shankar Vedantam. He's the host of the podcast and the public radio show Hidden Brain, which airs Saturday afternoons here at WHYY at 2 o'clock. He's author of a new book called Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. And you can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. I want to play a clip, and Shankar Vedantam does a reference this in his book. This is President Obama with Keegan-Michael Key, who played Luther. That was Obama's anger translator. And this is this translator translating what the president really felt at the April 2015 correspondence dinner. Let's give it a quick listen.
In our fast-changing world, traditions like the White House correspondence dinner are important.
I mean, really? What is this dinner? Do you really want to do this?
Because despite our differences, we count on the press to shed light on the most important issues of the day.
And we can count on Fox News to terrify old white people with some nonsense. Sharia law is coming to Cleveland, run for the damn hills. Y'all's ridiculous.
We won't always see eye to eye.
Oh, and CNN, thank you so much for the wall-to-wall Ebola coverage. For 2 whole weeks, we were one step away from the Walking Dead.
I love that, even after, 6 years? And Shankar Vedantam, I mean, it's a kind of perfect example of the sort of dual conversations that we're having when we're not being completely honest. And maybe that's just, you know, the sort of niceties of being a, you know, a polite person. Can you speak to what we were just listening to?
Sure. So in the sketch comedy Key and Peele, one of the conceits was that one of the characters played Obama, the Obama that most of us saw on television, who was always, you know, reserved and polite and courteous. And the other person channeled what Obama was feeling and thinking on the inside, the anger translator, as we saw in the clip. And what was hilarious about the clip is that in some ways it shows us what all of us have to do in our daily lives, and certainly in our professional lives. We don't say everything that's on our mind in the workplace. In fact, if we did, most of us would get fired within a week if we voiced every thought that we had in the workplace. And so we filter the things that we say. And some of the things we filter because professional courtesies require it. Some of the things we filter because we're just nice human beings, you know, and someone tells us what happened, where they went on vacation, or, you know, what they, you know, showed us a photograph of their kids. You know, maybe we're not that interested, but we sort of go along because we understand this is what's required to get membership in the human club. But these small acts of deception and self-deception, I would argue, are in some ways the building blocks of much larger deceptions and self-deceptions that we often see in our daily lives. And you can, again, see a good example. You know, you could make the case, if you're a rational, logical person, why can't you simply say everything that's on your mind? Why can't you simply voice every thought that goes through your head? And of course, we quickly realize that if we did that, we would often say things that are cruel or unkind to other people, and we often have to temper the desire to speak the truth with a desire to, in some ways, present what we say well. All of us have had bosses who basically tell us exactly what's on their mind and exactly the way they want to say it. And we find it extremely unpleasant to work for these people, to talk to these people. We often want bosses who are able to see the bigger picture, who are able to speak to us kindly. And in turn, that teaches us, when we become managers and bosses, to speak to other people kindly. So most of us don't think about kindness and politeness as acts of deception or delusion, but in some important ways they are. Perhaps they're trivial forms of deception and self-deception, but in some ways they're the building blocks of the delusions that in some ways take much bigger forms in the rest of our lives.
Let me take a giant leap and ask you about a QAnon. And as we all know, these are people that believe in some version of this story that the Democrats are a cabal of baby-eating Satanists. There were members of QAnon that attacked the U.S. Capitol when the votes were being counted on January 6th. QAnon said that Trump would become president on March 4th. Of course, that date has come and gone. Help us understand that level of self-delusion.
Yeah. So, I mean, delusions take a number of different forms, and it's important for me to state very, very clearly that just because I'm saying some delusions and some self-deceptions can be functional or useful, I am by no means suggesting that all self-deceptions can be useful or that they're good. All of us can see, even just a cursory glance through the last 100 years of history, can see all kinds of examples of delusions and self-deceptions that have produced terrible harms, including wars and genocide. But I do think that understanding delusions at the level of how our brains operate is very useful, even when it comes to combating dangerous delusions. Because I think the mistake that many of us make in the news media, Marty, is we assume that people are thinking and acting like computers. And so we believe that the way to fix delusions is to present correct information and to fact-check correct information. You know, over the course of the 4 years of the Trump presidency, various news organizations basically marshaled the enormous numbers of lies and falsehoods that came out of the Trump White House. I believe the Washington Post eventually cataloged more than 30,000 falsehoods and lies that came out of the Trump White House between 2016 and 2020. The net effect of all of this was between those two elections, Donald Trump received 11 million more votes in 2020 compared to 2016. QAnon might be sort of one part of it, but I think it's only a part of it. It's not part of the bigger picture. The point that I'm trying to make here is that all of us in some ways, you know, seek alternate versions of reality, partly because those alternate versions of reality are performing some kind of psychological function for us. More than half a century ago, the psychologist Leon Festinger infiltrated a group that believed that the end times were near. And Festinger infiltrated this group partly because he wanted to see what happened to people when the prophecy did not come true, when the day of judgment came and the world did not come to an end. How would people behave? And he expected that people would revise their opinions, that people would say, okay, I was wrong. I made a mistake. This was a false belief. I'm going to correct myself. But of course, when the day of judgment came and went, he found that the members of this group in some ways doubled down on their belief because in some ways they were confronted by a very painful dilemma. On the one hand, reality was telling them that the world had not come to an end and that their belief was a delusion and that it was wrong and false, and they had made mistakes by believing in this delusion. But this was very painful to do, so it became easier for them to come up with new stories that said, for example, the things that we took, this small group of people who believed that the end times were near, the actions that we took somehow headed off the end times from happening. You know, so if you think about QAnon and March 4th, you know, the fact that, you know, Donald Trump did not become president again on March 4th, ask yourself how many people who believed the QAnon theory changed their minds about QAnon on March 5th. And if the psychology is any guide, I would suggest that very, very few of those people did. But the larger lesson here, I think, Marty, is that when it comes to combating these delusions, I think rather than confronting them with facts, it might be more important to get under the hood of these delusions and ask, what is the psychological role these delusions are performing? Because if you actually want to combat a delusion, not just when, you know, a few thousand people show up at the Capitol when you can call out the National Guard, but when 30 million people have a delusion and you can't call out the National Guard to combat that level of delusion, you have to start asking, how do you combat the delusion at the level of its psychological underpinnings?
My understanding, too, is that a number of believers in QAnon now are focusing on the pandemic and the vaccine, that they all that energy, they are now focusing on something else. But just picking up, Shankar, on what you were just saying there. So if you have a member of the family, let's say, who believes in QAnon and you're having, you know, a distance dinner together outside somewhere, what is that conversation? How do you talk to someone like that?
Yeah, I remember talking with a friend of mine from college a couple of years ago, and very smart guy, good friend of mine. And he told me over dinner that he was convinced that the United States was behind the 9/11 attacks, that the CIA and the FBI had planned the 9/11 attacks and the U.S. had carried out these attacks in order to set up the conditions required for the invasion of the war in Iraq. I remember sitting at dinner with him and doing what we typically do when we confront people who have these crazy beliefs, which is I argued with him for 90 minutes or 2 hours and basically told him all the reasons why he could not possibly be correct. After writing this book, I've realized that my strategy was the wrong strategy. What I should have done was actually asked him a series of questions. I should have asked him how he came to this point of view, why he believed what it meant, ask him deeper questions to explain how it was that this conspiracy could have taken place, and then try and also ask him what it meant for him that this belief actually was true. What did it mean for him to believe that the United States had carried out the 9/11 attacks? What psychological purpose did it serve that he had this belief? And I believe that if I'd pursued this course of action, I might not have changed his mind. You know, changing people's minds are not easy. But it's possible I would have had more success than using the conventional route. Because, of course, exactly as you said, the moment March 4th comes and goes, there's a new conspiracy theory that pops up. So in some ways, when you try and address the conspiracy theory at the level of its factual claims, it's like playing whack-a-mole. You know, one thing disappears, the next thing pops up. You address that next thing, the next thing pops up. Because at its heart, what's really happening is not the specific set of facts that are really in dispute, but the underlying psychology that really is driving this. If you can't address this at the level of the underlying psychology, if you in some ways can't reach people at the level of their underlying hopes and fears, what hope do you have of confronting the delusion? Go back to the Church of Love story that we mentioned at the beginning. the ultimate solution for the Church of Love story was not to convince these people that the letters they were receiving for many years were fake. The ultimate solution was in some ways to provide these people with the things that were missing in their lives, because it was the absence of love, the absence of connection, their loneliness, their vulnerability that made their belief possible. It's exactly the same when you think about demagogues throughout history. Yes, we should confront demagogues. We should fact check them. We should do what the news media is doing. But in many ways, the story that demagogues tell is appealing because it's speaking to people's underlying psychological needs. If you don't address those underlying psychological needs, yes, you might get rid of one dictator, one demagogue, but the next one is right around the corner.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That very familiar voice is Shankar Vedantam. He's the host of Hidden Brain, which is both a radio show and a podcast. You can hear it Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock here at WHYY. He's also written a book with Bill Messer, and it's titled Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. And again, you can join us with your questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Shankar, I'm also thinking about or asking, wondering about just the power of the group. And oftentimes what people are willing to do in a group is not something they would necessarily do by themselves. But I wonder, how do you see the role of kind of group psychology when it comes to these so-called useful delusions?
Yeah, so if you think again about our evolutionary history, humans are not the strongest species that's around. You know, we don't have the biggest muscles or the biggest claws or the, you know, the largest teeth. We're not the fastest animal that's around. And so what is our, you know, value proposition as a species? What is it that allows us to survive and thrive? I would argue that the thing that allows us to survive and thrive is that we're able to form bonds with other people and look out for one another. That, in other words, our capacity to act as a group allows us to do tremendous things. So in our societies today, you know, we have some people who are very good at farming and some people who are very good at computers and some people who are very good at supply chains. And you have a society that's deeply interconnected in lots of different ways, which is how our society is able to function, right? We're all, if you're out in the wild by yourself, how long would you survive? You know, very few of us would survive more than a week if we were completely on our own, living on our own wits. So the fact that in some ways we needed one another to survive means that our brains, again, product of evolution, right, are going to, in some ways, discover the importance of group ties and group bonds. So in other words, the brains that we have are designed in some ways to forge very deep bonds with one another because, of course, those bonds in our evolutionary history are what kept us alive. Our reliance on the tribe, our reliance and faith in the group, the group's loyalty to us, our loyalty to the groups, these are things that allowed our ancestors to survive. It was not logical, deductive reasoning or peer-reviewed studies that allowed our ancestors to survive. It was group bonds and group loyalties. So when you look at group psychology, this is why human beings are often willing to do things that on the surface might appear to be irrational. Why would anyone sign up to go off and fight in a war for your group when, in fact, you might end up dead? At a very logical, rational level, how does being dead improve your chances of doing anything in life? And the answer is, of course, it doesn't, right? And so the reason people are willing to sign up and do these very heroic and difficult things is precisely because the brain has algorithms built into it that tell us, listen to the group, follow the group, be loyal to the group. Now, you can see very good things that happen from this. You can see movements, for example, like the civil rights movement or, you know, the fight against Nazi Germany, where, you know, large numbers of people were able to band together and fight for a greater good. You can see all kinds of ways, positive things that come from such kind of group loyalties. You can also, on the other hand, see how these group loyalties can produce catastrophe. On the other side of the equation in World War II, you had delusional beliefs in Nazi Germany that provided and produced, you know, genocidal thinking. You see group loyalties in our politics today, in our partisanship today, that keep people from being able to see the facts. In both cases, there's an underlying common psychology that in some ways has held, you know, has held us in good stead in our evolutionary and our ancestral history. It can have very good effects, it can have very bad effects, but it's important to understand the psychological roots of this behavior if we are to do something about the beliefs that are dangerous.
We have a couple of comments here, and we're almost up on a break here. Let me just read a comment from Anne. She says, what happens when our delusions hurt us, as in PTSD? PTSD. Is there a way to, quote unquote, reprogram the delusion? What do you think, Shankar?
Yeah, so we should have a longer conversation just about the role of delusion and reality in mental health in general.
Yeah.
But I think certainly PTSD is an excellent example, because that's an example of where a trauma has happened and the person in some ways is bound by that trauma so powerfully that they're not able to live a healthy, productive, and fruitful life because that trauma has the trauma they've experienced in the past. Now, you can see again at a certain level why this would be functional to do. If we simply forgot traumatic things that happened to us, you could argue, wouldn't it be better that we just simply forget traumatic things that happened to us? No, evolutionarily speaking, this would be a very bad idea. If something traumatic happened to you, you actually want to be able to remember that traumatic thing, so you try and avoid that thing happening again to you in the future. So it's very useful to have minds that are vigilant to trauma, that delusionally see trauma in the hand of trauma in our daily lives. You can also see how that spills over into mental illness or a disorder where it becomes so all-consuming that we can't actually live our lives. So the paradoxical thing is simultaneously, we want to remember the traumas that happened to us, but we want to remember them in small enough doses so that the traumas are functional to us as opposed to dysfunctional to us. And much mental health, much counseling, much psychotherapy involves finding this balance where in some ways you're able to see your past in a way that becomes functional for you as you're moving forward.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We've got folks that want to join us as well. And again, talking with Shankar Vedantam, host of Hidden Brain. It's both a radio show and a podcast. And he's written a book with Bill Messler. It's titled Useful Delusions. It's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. And it's subtitled The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. We're going to talk more about what's in the book here as well. And again, looking for your questions and comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Fleetwood Mac's Little Lies from 1987 album Tango in the Night, talking about lies and delusions with our guest Shankar Vedantam, author of a new book, Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. Let me get Dan from Winmore to join our conversation. And Dan, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi. I understand why people may follow a set of conspiracy theories. They need an explanation for things that they don't understand. It's a nice story. It's a joining a group dynamic. But what's the motivation on the other side? I would understand somebody like the Church of Love. Maybe it's monetary. Maybe it's control. But something like QAnon, now HBO, I just read, may have identified it as some guy who ran 8chan, this guy Ron Watkins in the Philippines. Unless they're getting paid by some other country to sow dissent here or whatever, what's the motivation behind starting conspiracy theory and supporting it?
Fair enough. Dan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Shankar, go ahead.
Dan, that's an excellent question. You know, I've come to think about conspiracy theories a little bit like viruses. And, you know, we've all been through a pandemic, so we've thought a lot about viruses the last 12 months. But in some ways, asking why a virus grows and thrives might actually not be the right question, right? Because the truth is, there are viruses all over the world, thousands and thousands of them, that are basically popping up all over the place. There are probably hundreds of coronaviruses, different kinds of, you know, flu viruses, all kinds of different threats and pathogens are basically around us all the time. Why does one of those viruses set off a global pandemic while the next 10,000 don't? And the answer in some ways is not in the virus itself, but the answer is in the host population. You know, so in other words, a virus will spread if it has the conditions that are right for it to spread. If the conditions are not right for it to spread, the virus might not be successful. So in some ways, I think we make a mistake where we say, let's look at the individual conspiracy theory. Let's look at the person who started this individual conspiracy theory and try and explain why it is this particular theory has resonance. The answer for why something spreads lies in sort of very complex network theory of how these complicated phenomena grow and spread. And this is true for viruses, but it's also true for conspiracy theories. You know, it has so happened that I think QAnon has come to be associated with a political movement in the United States. And it's come to be that if you're part of a political group, the various political tribes that we have in the country, it's difficult to deviate from the beliefs of your tribe. Because when you deviate from the beliefs of your tribe, your brain is telling you bad things are going to happen to you. Because in your evolutionary history, standing by the tribe is when the tribe stands by you. And so we all, this is true not just for people on one side of the political spectrum, it's true for people on all sides of every political spectrum in every country. People follow the allegiances of their tribes because their tribes give them comfort. Their tribes give them support. They believe that if they follow the tribe will lead them to good things. Now, again, it's not the case that tribal loyalties are always a bad thing. I want to be very careful here.
Sure.
There are times that in some ways these loyalties can hold us in very good stead. Human beings need one another. We're not solitary creatures. But there can also be times when these can be deeply dangerous. One of the things that I think psychologists have talked about is a phenomenon called the illusion of explanatory depth. And I just want to mention this in the context of Dan's question, because the illusion of explanatory depth is, if I asked you, how does a bicycle work? And you might say, I have a pretty good idea of how a bicycle works. So I say, well, just explain it to me. Tell me how a bicycle is put together. Can you draw a bicycle for me? It turns out that when you ask people to actually explain the things that they think they know, people in many ways realize that they actually don't know the things that they thought that they knew. And this is why it's very useful for a teacher to tell a student, I know you think you know the answer to the math problem, but come up to the front of the class and write out the answer on the blackboard. Sure. When you're asked to demonstrate your knowledge of something, it's a very powerful way to show the illusion of explanatory depth, that in fact you don't know things as well as you thought you know them. Ask yourself, what would happen if we brought the same idea to combating conspiracy theories? Instead of arguing with people with conspiracy theories, if we ask them, explain to me in depth how this works. If you believe the United States was behind the 9/11 attacks, explain to me how it works. What would have been necessary for this to happen? What are the other conditions that would have to be met? We might discover that people might feel or realize that, in fact, they are not as certain of the things that they thought they were certain about. I think it's going to be a much more effective way than actually combating them head on with a bunch of facts that they in some ways can argue against.
Let me tell something I read. I think it was the Washington Post this morning, and it was a story about a focus group, I think of largely Republicans. They were suspicious of this COVID vaccine. They had, you know, vaccine hesitancy, as we call it. They were worried about long-term effects, and it was a new vaccine, and they didn't think politicians were being honest, even government scientists. They didn't think were being honest. And one of the quotes was, we want to be educated, not indoctrinated. And apparently the person who changed their mind, and apparently he really did, was a former head of the CDC. He gave them facts. He talked about doctors being vaccinated. He talked about the long-term effects of COVID compared to how someone might respond to a vaccine, you know, feeling sick for 24 hours. And they didn't like the PSA that the recent presidents except for Trump had put together. They did not like that. Does that tell us something about how to appeal to people who, in the face of this pandemic, just are so suspicious of what we can do to address it?
Yeah, I want to start out by saying the facts are really important. Science really is vitally important. It is important to know exactly what the right answers are and to make sure those answers are communicated clearly, often, and well to the general public. I don't want to take anything away from that. But I am saying that beyond that, there are additional things that we should do. So, for example, I think that story that you're referring to, Marty, speaks to the idea that so many facts that we have in our public space right now have become politicized. Now, we wish they were not politicized. I certainly wish that the facts around the COVID pandemic were not politicized. They were not seen as liberal or conservative facts, that they are seen as scientific facts. But the fact that they have become politicized tells us something really important, that if we actually want to reach people, it might be important very deliberately to have this be communicated outside the boundaries of partisan politics. And in some ways, politicians and presidents might not be the best people. They might not be the best vehicles, because when a president speaks, it's difficult to disentangle the president from the politics of that president. And so in some ways, we might need to hear from neutral parties. It might also be that we do need to hear from people who are people who we think of as members of our own group, our own tribe. There have been other research, for example, finding that when you want to communicate certain facts to people, it's really important that people hear them from members of their own tribe rather than members of a different tribe. And again, you can argue at a rational, logical level, this makes no sense. You know, the facts about COVID are the facts about COVID. How does it matter who's communicating those facts? But at a human level, it does matter. It does matter. We all care deeply about the opinions of people whom we like and admire, the opinions of our family and our friends and trusted groups. And when we hear a message from those trusted people, we're more likely to absorb that message. At its core, my book has a very pragmatic approach. It basically says there are certain outcomes that we want, whether we're confronting a pandemic or we're confronting something like global climate change. It's less important to say we've won the argument, and it's more important to actually see the change that we want to see. It's more important to see people vaccinated. It's more important for all of us to take the steps that will help to combat climate change. How we get there should be less important than the actual goal of getting there.
And the question of is sort of what are the steps in order to, I mean, I do think it is important to figure out how we get there, because I think that's what we all want. But let me read a couple of more comments from our listeners. Actually, this is a question from Natalie. She says, how do you deal with a pathological liar?
Yeah, I mean, it is difficult to deal with a pathological liar, and it may be that at a certain level there are some people who are going to be outside the bounds of communication. I will just say that pay attention, Natalie, to sort of the typical way we deal with pathological liars, and this is the way we've been trying to deal with these problems for many, many years. We confront those people with arguments and with facts. Ask yourself when it was you confronted a pathological liar, presented him or her with a set of facts, and found him or her changing their mind. How often has that happened to you? And if you've tried it many times, and in fact it hasn't worked, is it possible a different approach might be more effective? Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, being empathetic to people who have delusions and in trying to understand what it is that's causing their delusions is always going to succeed. I'm not suggesting that. It may well be that when people are showing up with pitchforks and guns at your door, when people are marching on the U.S. Capitol because they believe a conspiracy theory, that is not an appropriate time to produce a psychological explanation for what happens. At that point, you actually do have to call out the National Guard. You do have to call out the police. You do have to call out the military. But you can't call out the military and the National Guard when 30 million people believe the same thing. When 30 million people believe the same thing, you have to do something about that underlying belief. And it's my contention that approaching this question with less animosity, with less anger, with less argument, with more compassion, with more understanding, and trying to get at the underlying psychology is more likely to be successful.
Here's a question from Peter. Does the guest think people have invented religion as a delusion to save them from their fear of mortality? I mean, you know, that's a subject of an entire separate hour, but a quick answer, Shankar.
Yeah, there's an entire chapter in Useful Delusions that focuses on the growth of religion and the rise of religion and the functions that religion might play in our societies. There's certainly been a lot of research in recent years that argues that as humans move from small hunter-gatherers tribes, you know, groups of 100 or 150 people, nomadic groups, to more, you know, agriculture-based societies that were fixed in place, but also much larger, you know, thousands and then tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands, religions arose in these societies partly as a way, as a social innovation, as a profoundly important social innovation that helped in some ways regulate how these groups operated, that helped people solve what are called collective action dilemmas, in other words, to arrive at common purpose. I certainly think that religion could play a very powerful role today in accomplishing all manner of different things. There was a recent article, I believe, in the New York Times this past week talking about the role that clergy are playing in helping spread awareness of the effectiveness of the COVID vaccine and the effectiveness that that clergy people could play in getting people to sign on in getting COVID shots around the world. I was speaking some years ago with Danny Kahneman, the Nobel Prize-winning psychologist, and he was talking about the role of religion in combating climate change. Is it possible in some ways that there are really important goals that all of us share, that in some ways the best way to advance those goals are through belief systems? Now, whether those belief systems are actually true or actually false, to me, is almost beside the point. If, in fact, religious belief can help large numbers of people get vaccinated against COVID and help the planet as a whole survive the dangers of climate change, I, for one, say, you know, sign me up. My principal goal is not to win the argument. My principal goal is to have a planet that is habitable in 100 or 200 years.
We have several people with the same, basically the same question about what they describe as the delusion of white supremacy, asking what is the staying power of that in American politics. Is there a short answer to that, Shankar?
You know, all delusions in some ways function because I think the question to ask always with a delusion is ask, what purpose is this delusion serving? So in other words, I think so many of us are so upset by the content of delusional beliefs, by the content of what the belief actually is, that we don't stop to ask the question, what function is this serving? Now, when it comes to something like white supremacy, you could argue that it serves a very practical and obvious purpose. It helps to keep some people in power and keep other people out of power. So there's a very straightforward explanation for how that delusion can operate. But you can also see all kinds of subtle ways in which white supremacy can operate that in some ways are not just about power equations, but much more subtle things. I think the fundamental principle that I'm applying is, both with useful delusions and dangerous delusions, stepping back and examining them with curiosity and asking what is the underlying function that this delusion is producing might lead us in some ways to combating the delusions that are dangerous and potentially also embracing the delusions that are functional.
Help us in the couple minutes we have left about how what you describe as bulletproofing rituals, how they help us.
Yeah, so the bulletproofing rituals is an entire section of the book that talks about beliefs that have arisen in different parts of the world where people come up with rituals that they believe will ward off the trajectory of a bullet. And of course, you would imagine that if anything can be falsifiable, a bulletproofing ritual is easily falsifiable because if I practice the ritual and I get shot, presumably I'm going to quickly realize my ritual was not actually useful. But these rituals have taken hold in many parts of the world, disparate parts of the world. And one of the things that I argue is that the rise of rituals in general and the fact that many of us practice rituals, not just bulletproofing rituals, but rituals before sports games or rituals in the face of a pandemic or religious rituals, all of these are ways in which we cope with a difficult, unpredictable, and anxiety-producing world. You could see that in some ways these rituals can be counterproductive. You can see how sometimes they can tip over into madness and cruelty and dangerous delusions. But you can also see lots of ways in which these rituals can be functional, not least in increasing and enhancing the bonds that we have with fellow members of our group, with fellow members of our tribes.
And the power of belief, right?
Indeed. I think there's ample evidence that if we could rid our brains of all the beliefs that we have, it's not clear to me that our lives would actually be improved. If in fact, that we could live all our lives purely by logic and reason, it's not clear to me that, in fact, our lives would, in fact, be much improved. Certainly when it comes to mental health, this is a question that I think Anne raised several minutes ago. There is ample evidence that mental health might, in fact, involve seeing the world optimistically, that seeing the world in some ways delusionally might actually be really important for us in coping with the unexpectedness and the difficulties of the lives that we lead.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Shankar Vedantam. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's been a pleasure, Mari. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And his book is called Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen, and we're going to close things out with Eric Idle singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, the closing scene from the 1979 movie Monty Python's Life of Brian.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the right side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain.